with me when I went to interview Mitt Romney at a summit he holds every June in Deer Valley, Utah. He tested my microphone at the convention hall. We went on the chairlifts. We went on the Alpine coaster. He loved it all. Likewise, I took Yardley with me to the debates in Iowa in 2012. I'd be sitting in the Iowa Convention Center, pumping in the bathroom stalls. Those pumps are so loud. And pushing her around the convention center in a stroller. As long as she was moving, she was happy. I'd push her around during meetings, and then my colleagues would take a turn around the debate prep table. I have a picture of Yards at Newt Gingrich's podium before the Iowa debate that I figure she can use if she ever runs for president. I propose the caption, Born to Run. In December 2013, I was on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno. It was his last month on the show. I was still nursing Thatcher, so he and Doug came with me. Thatch was being pretty good backstage, but he started to have a meltdown right before I went on stage. So I did what any working mother would do. I nursed him while sitting there, mic'd and glammed up. Time stopped for a minute, and then I pulled up my dress, handed the baby to Doug, and hurried on stage, carrying a tissue because I had a hideous hacking cold. Ah, the glamorous life. When it came time for my second Fortune Most Powerful Women event, this one in Washington, D.C., I took Yardley with me, and we headed south on the train. Where are we going? She asked. This is a gathering of a bunch of women, I said, who have done amazing things. They're coming together to celebrate their power and how strong they are and how much they've accomplished. Are we two of them? She asked me. After I gave my remarks, she was running around the lobby of the hotel, and I was talking to some women while keeping an eye on her out of my peripheral vision. Suddenly I looked over, and she was supine on the ground with her fist in the air. A beautiful symbol of power, solidarity, and sheer exhaustion. I marvel at my friends who are full-time mothers. I don't know how they do it. One of my closest friends is a stay-at-home mom. I think she has it harder, and she thinks I have it harder. She's always remarking on how present I am when I'm with my kids. But to me, full-time caregiving is what's truly amazing. If I were with my kids full-time, I couldn't sustain that level of engagement. When Doug and I have the kids all day, every day on vacation, I am wiped out. If I were a stay-at-home mom, I like to think I could get to be as good as my friends, but it would take time and patience. The truth is, I always knew that if I became a mom, I would be a working mother. I love that I can go out into the world, and then, when I walk into that house, I'm full of excitement and energy. The kids experience it by osmosis. They see that I love my job. They understand that they can find a job someday that they will really love. I hope they're really learning that. I also hope they're learning that one of the best ways to make this work is to find a supportive spouse. Neither Doug nor I came in with any strong biases about gender roles. When we got together, he made more money than I did. Now I make more, and probably that will cycle around many more times over the rest of our lives. He is not threatened because he's secure. It helps that we both now love what we do. Our kids see that Doug and I support each other's goals. When we got married, Doug was running a company down in Palm Beach. He was splitting his time between there and New York, and he was not enjoying that travel once Yates was born. He was clearly not happy. It wasn't the most productive, healthy work environment. We went for a walk in Central Park. I suggested he try to figure out what might make him more fulfilled. He's like my dad was, a voracious reader and a master of observation. Doug had been writing a book as a stress reliever on all those airplane rides. He told me he loved writing and thought it was something he could pursue. Why don't I read your book? I said. It was nerve-wracking for both of us. What if I hated it? Luckily, I didn't. In fact, I loved it. It's called Ghosts of Manhattan, and it is beautifully written. If you read that book, you'll know why I love Doug. I encouraged him to quit his job and try to become a published author. Off he went. He sold off a large part of the company and started writing full-time, and he's never looked back. That book became a New York Times bestseller. He cares deeply about his writing and has networked in the writing community very well. He's in a super-secret book club with some very famous authors and writers. I've already said too much. He creates these gatherings like my mom and dad used to do, where they talk about things other than politics, literature, storytelling, possibilities. Doug's next book, The Means, also sold big. The main character is a little bit me and a little bit Melissa Francis, who started out on Little House on the Prairie and is now a newscaster at Fox and a good friend. It was funny, when I was reading early drafts, I'd write in the margins, "Hey, that's my story!" So if you've read The Means and any stories in here sound like the ones in Doug's book, just know they were mine originally. Now Doug's publishing a third book, called Trophy Son. And I have to say that career has been great for him and for us. Other than for the 3 weeks after his publication dates, Doug can make his own hours and usually writes in the mornings after school drop-offs. It allows us a lot of flexibility. He can get the kids to Fox for an office picnic. He and I can meet for a nice lunch. Every once in a while, we make a Broadway matinee or take a walk in Central Park. If I have to leave town to cover breaking news, he can cover for me. And I leave knowing my children are with not just a nanny, but a parent they love, which alleviates some of the guilt. Thankfully, I don't have to travel much, but I do put in long hours at the office, especially in election years. We're teaching our kids that moms support dads and dads support moms, and the main goal is that the family unit thrive. They are learning the importance of true connection because they see and feel and live it in our home. They are also learning that being unhappy at the office long term is not acceptable. We want our kids to think, "I can do better than that. I can find something that invigorates me." We want them to be excited and challenged by what they do. To find that, you have to get a good education. You have to work hard for good things to happen. We find ways to inculcate Kelly family values, which thankfully Doug happens to share. One time, Yates and I were playing a game. "Yates," I said, "you're going to win." "Maybe we could all win," he said. "No," I said, "we cannot all win. There is a winner and a loser. Losing is an incentive to keep practicing." Doug and I want them to understand that. Right now, my daughter doesn't like competition because she doesn't like losing. And she's usually playing against Yates, who's got 19 months on her. I think she also doesn't like to be in a position to make other people lose. I want her to understand the value of competition and winning and losing, but I'm also conscious of not putting my own competitiveness off on her. They can be whoever they are. Our way isn't always right. We encourage them to do things themselves. Order their own meals at restaurants, pour their own milk in their cereal, clear their own place settings. Inspired by my dad, Doug and I will go around the dinner table and ask, "What's the report?" Each child gets a turn, and sure enough, they go on and on. We try not to interrupt. Dinners are long. When we go to the airport, we have the kids get us to our gate. These little things build confidence. This is not to say Doug and I have it all figured out, far from it. This is just how we approach parenthood and find ways to enjoy one another more. Just like with Linda, we have a lot of laughs. I'll come out in the morning with my hair sticking straight up, my glasses on, and no makeup, and I'll start posing dramatically like a runway model, telling the kids if they want my styling secrets, it's going to cost them big, since I am a very famous person, and I don't just give these gems out to anyone. Yates will deadpan to me, "That's not your best look." One thing that was always worth a laugh in the Kelly house growing up was when anyone tripped, usually my mother. There would be a moment's hesitation just to make sure the person was not hurt, but just a moment, and then laughter would follow. It's built into me to this day, like the response, "God bless you," to a sneeze. It's almost instinctual. I cannot help it, and I take no responsibility for it. It's all my mother's fault. One time, Doug tripped coming off a curb and thought he got away with it. "I just want you to know, I saw everything," I said from behind him. We both burst out laughing. Then Yardley chimed in. "I thought it wasn't nice to laugh when other people tripped." Doug smiled. "It's complicated," I said. Just like in my career, I work hard at motherhood. And I have to because motherhood takes practice. It's trial and error. Once, my mom and I were out with Yates when he was a baby. I was gazing at him lovingly in his stroller. After a while, my mom got exasperated. "Talk to him," she said. "What? You should talk to him." Oh, I had been so busy admiring him, it hadn't even occurred to me. Good idea. A few months later, we were out at the Jersey Shore, staying with Doug's mother. Yates was about 9 months old. It was a rainy day, and so I took him to the arcade. I thought he'd like the stimuli. Sure enough, he loved it, and then he fell asleep. I didn't have anywhere to be, so I decided to play skee-ball while he slept in the stroller next to me. I was doing really well. Like, really well. I kept hitting 50s and the 100, which is hard to do. It was a rush. I was a new mother. I had very little excitement in my life. Then Yates woke up and started crying. I had 4 balls left. What would you do? It was a question of maybe 30 seconds, tops. I decided to finish my game. So there I am, rolling skee balls, saying to Yates, "Mommy just needs 1 more second." At that exact moment, a woman comes up and says, "Excuse me, aren't you Megyn Kelly?" "No," I said, rolling that last ball and picking up my baby. "Who?" Now that they're older, I take all 3 of them with me and let them roll right alongside me. It's utopia. With practice, I have gotten better at both skee-ball and parenting. But just as you get the hang of taking care of one child, you have 2 and then 3, and you realize, usually the hard way, that the old tricks are not working. What I know now is that the moms who make it look easy also had to learn. Once, when Thatcher was a newborn, I took him in the stroller and went to pick up my 2 older kids at preschool. It was cloudy, but I didn't bring an umbrella. You can't take the stroller into the school, which I forgot. So I got to the school and had to wake up Thatcher to carry him upstairs. So now I had a crying baby and my 2 little ones, and it started to rain. The stroller wasn't collapsible, so I couldn't get a taxi, even if I could find one. I thought, I'll take the subway. But I couldn't get down the stairs with the stroller and a baby and 2 little kids. So what did I do? I exercised my advanced problem-solving skills. I sat on the church steps across from the school with the 3 of them and cried. In the rain. That, as it turned out, was not really a solution. So, I stood up. We walked 10 blocks in the rain. We got soaked, but we got home, and everyone was fine. I knew I needed to do it differently next time. Once I was dry and sitting at the kitchen table, I thought, what was I trying to prove? I had a nanny. She could have watched Thatcher while I picked up the older kids. But I was trying to prove that I could do it all. And so I took the baby, even though it made my life more difficult. And for what? My baby would not have cared if his mom wasn't there for an hour of his nap. As mothers, we tend to put pressure on ourselves, especially as working moms, even if we push ourselves to the point of frustration. I realize now that it's better to take a 45-minute nap, if you can, and be present for your kids with calm or positive energy thereafter, than to power through and be a miserable version of yourself. Live and learn. I am still learning. Not long ago, I went to the park with Yates and another boy and that boy's mom, who stays home and seems to me like an excellent mother. I left the house with 2 things, me and Yates. The other mom brought a backpack to the playground, and while the kids were running around, she took it out. "Mom, I'm thirsty," her son said. Out came a juice box. Ah, juice boxes. Smart move. "Would Yates like one too?" she said. "He would. Thank you so much." Then the boys were hungry. Out came some dried fruit and nut snack. Oh, snacks, right. Well played. And after that, sidewalk chalk. Chalk, a brilliant idea. And then, how about a ball? Soccer, yes, they like soccer. I went home laughing at myself. But I knew, too, that while all of those things from the backpack were nice, to have a good day, all Yates and I really needed was time with each other. Finding that time is perhaps my greatest challenge as a working mother. Most American working moms have been asked at some point, how do you balance it all? Many say the question is sexist because we would not ask it of a man. I suppose that's true, but the reality is, some things are different between the sexes, and in my experience, guilt at being at work all day is often one of them. Every working mom I know, from part-time freelance consultant to killer Wall Street hedge fund guru, has guilt about missing out on her kids' day. I don't hear this as much from my male friends, although there are exceptions like my executive producer Tom, who's devoted to his son and often expresses those pangs of missing out. In general, however, most of the men I know seem to be in a better place when it comes to leaving in the morning and coming home in the evening and being informed about the child's day, as opposed to having been there for it. To me, some of this is inherent. The reality is that mothers have a biological need to be with their children, especially when they're young. To be strong women, I don't think we have to reject that reality, that particularly special bond between mothers and children. That's not to say that women working is the calamity Lou Dobbs and Eric Erickson were suggesting. It's just to acknowledge the emotional toll on mothers who choose to do it all. Sometimes, it's hard. In my view, the way forward is to be honest about this fact and to better support new mothers, rather than to guilt them about their choices. Our society also bears some of the blame. It rarely reinforces the message to women that it's okay or expected, much less admirable, for them to go out and earn the money it takes to sustain a family. Too often, shame still attaches to maternity leave, or to getting pregnant at all as a working mother, to taking days off when a child is sick, to slowing down one's workflow when one's children are very young or having a difficult time. These are important things for a mother to do, and yet the American workplace remains reluctant to embrace them. In addition, the failure to celebrate working mothers is similarly damaging. Dads are given credit for supporting their families. When was the last time you heard a mother praised for working all day? I believe in what billionaire Charles Koch's dad referred to as the glorious feeling of accomplishment. There is no reason to feel guilty about enjoying hard work or pushing yourself at the office just because you're also a mom or a dad. A job well done at work enhances our self-worth, brings joy and satisfaction for women and men, and it has the added benefit of teaching that value to our children when we go home to them at the end of the day. In my little circle of the world on the Kelly File, I have resolved to build a better environment for parents. I encourage our working mothers to celebrate and not feel guilty about their work, just like the dads. I'm not saying this always works, but we do try. But we are realistic. When the women get pregnant, I also try to make sure they don't feel pressure at the office. I'll say, I know that once the baby comes, you may need more flexibility for a while, and we'll help make that happen. If they are feeling overwhelmed, I tell them, don't just quit and give up the struggle. Come to me and Tom first and see if we can help. Similarly, if our guys need extra time with their kids, we all work to accommodate that. We're a team. If filling these gaps requires temporary extra headcount or additional hours for those who didn't just have a baby or some adjustment to people's work responsibilities, so be it. It's to the employer's benefit. If you support new parents' need to be with their children during a decent parental leave and then within reason thereafter, you are far more likely to keep them long-term. And that probably is one of the reasons why half of the people on my staff have babies or are pregnant. One producer who I love moved to damn Canada and had a Canadian baby. What the hell, Deb? I told her. We'll work out some arrangement. And we did. It's not that we have unlimited resources, trust me. It's just that only women can have the babies. If society wants the human race to continue, they're going to have to help us out here. Also, we're talking about a time-limited situation. There are very few Duggars out there with 19 children. It's unlikely the women on my team will be having babies every year for the next 20 years. We're talking about a few years when we need to get some backup. We can do that to hang on to our top talent. And to the employers of the world thinking, this is insane, it'll hurt the bottom line. Just remember, if you force a woman to choose between her work and her child, and she has any choice at all, she will choose her child. And then you will lose her and all the money you've spent training her, which you will then have to spend again on a new person, when the cycle will likely continue unless you hire all men or postmenopausal women, which happens to be illegal. For me, the balance between work and home has gotten both better and worse over time. Better because when I first became a mother, I worried about two things: that my children would not feel bonded to me if I wasn't there all day, and that I was somehow shirking my responsibilities in choosing to go to the office. Wrong on both counts, as it turns out. As for my fear that our bond wouldn't be as strong, I now know that's nonsense, at least if you put in the effort. 7 years into motherhood, I love my children, and they love me. Our relationship is fully intact and secure. So I no longer worry about them being confused by our setup or estranged from me as a result. As for shirking my responsibilities, I've been able to let that go. At first, I felt sad and, yes, guilty about not being the one doing all the baths and meals and drop-offs. But soon I realized that even if I can't do it all, what I really need is good time with them, where we feel connected, playing, talking, sitting together. I don't need to get them from point A to point B each day to prove a point. One day, I was getting ready for work and feeling a little sad. I didn't want to go in. I wanted to stay with my kids. Our occasional sitter, who is from Bolivia, was there. She's a hard worker. She cleans houses. She's a full-time nanny for another family. Her husband drives a cab. She has two kids of her own. She saw me changing Yardley's diaper at the time with tears in my eyes and put her hand on my back. She said softly, "There are many ways of taking care of them." And she was right. But the thing that still haunts me, the thing I do still worry about, is that I'm missing too much of it. That's what keeps me up at night. It's not that they're not going to turn out well. They are. It's not that they won't love me or appreciate my efforts on their behalf. They do, and they will. It's that I'm missing large chunks of their childhood, like most working parents do. Settling for more right now for me means pushing myself to improve this balance. Keep my job and spend more time with my kids. That's the next reinvention. I love my job and the excitement and challenges it offers, but my job does not define me. If this job ended tomorrow, I'd find another way to find that glorious feeling of accomplishment. No employer or career choice made me. I made me, and Linda and Ed made me, and my children made me, and they and Doug are the people, the only people, who have true power over me. Chapter 19, Election Season. My family knows that election season brings big demands on my time. What it also brings is vitriol, a tidal wave of it. Even as a news anchor, you have to gird yourself for battle. During the lead-up to the 2008 election, Doug and I were at a cocktail party in Park Slope, Brooklyn. As soon as I was introduced as a Fox News anchor, the couple we were talking to turned and walked out. 4 years later, we were at a dinner party in Manhattan, and the woman next to me asked, "You work for Fox? How do you sleep at night?" "Like a baby," I responded. "The check clears every week, and we provide a service to the nation. And you?" The point is, things always get tense as presidential politics fire up. That makes elections the best and worst thing to cover. I love the excitement, the competition, the high stakes. The anger, accusations, and demonization I could do without. Never do I reassess life on the political front lines more than during election years. The truth is, it's always far more than just a year. And entering the 2016 presidential race, I knew the process would require endurance. The first Republican candidate, Ted Cruz, announced in March 2015, more than 19 months before the election. Babies would be born on election day whose parents had not yet met when the race got started. We were going to be with these guys for a long time. For the first few months of the primary season, our show was like a revolving door for the Republican candidates. We asked for the Democrats, too, but they generally chose not to come on Fox News. If they wanted to ignore the largest cable news audience in the country, there wasn't much I could do about it, other than incessantly ask them to reconsider, which I did. Virtually every one of the Republicans came to the Kelly File within 24 hours of their official announcement, and we'd talk about their bios, their policy, and the race. Slowly but surely, we were helping America get to know them. By the time we got to the summer of 2015, the GOP had 17 candidates. 17! It was an absolute mob scene. I understood why a lot of Republican politicians thought they had a shot. We were coming off of 8 years of the Obama administration, and America tends to want a change of party after a two-term president. With so many candidates, the debates were going to be key, and Fox News was lucky enough to be hosting the first one. It was scheduled for August 6th in Cleveland, on the same stage where the GOP victor would accept the nomination 1 year later. There were so many candidates that not all of them could possibly participate in one debate. We discussed the problem at length. Should there be two debates with the candidates mixed up randomly? Just one with the top polling candidates only and nothing for the others? In the end, Fox settled on two debates, one for those with the highest poll numbers, one for the lower tier. The Fox management team would choose five national polls and take the average to figure out the 10 who were polling the highest. Most of the folks relegated to the undercard debate were not happy, and some complained. But in no world did it make sense to put 17 candidates on that stage. We felt comfortable with our approach. Voters needed help figuring out what distinguished each candidate from the other, and that's where Fox News came in. I had moderated presidential debates 4 years earlier, so I knew the drill. The debate team would be spending many, many hours meeting with one another and preparing for the big night. I was not looking forward to the extra hours away from Doug and our kids, but I was also mindful of the importance of the work. It is the most rewarding thing we do, the biggest professional responsibility we have. We take it very seriously. One person dismissed by all of the pundits at first was Donald Trump. When Trump had announced just a couple of months earlier, his poll numbers were dreadful, in the low single digits. No one thought of him then as anything more than an entertaining diversion. For the first half of the summer, everyone was just enjoying the show. The smart money back then was on Jeb Bush. Jeb was seen as presidential. He was smart and had experience. Maybe it's that he's from American royalty, which the Bush family certainly is. But he looked and felt like other presidents. And yet, he didn't have that special thing that presidents usually have. The unbridled confidence, the moxie. He gave his first television one-on-one to me after a speech at Liberty University. It did not go particularly well for him. He told me the Iraq War was not a mistake. I asked him, knowing what we know now, would you have invaded Iraq? He said yes. We went back to his team for clarification before the interview hit air, because the exchange was a little confusing. His team was steadfast, we have nothing to clarify. We put it on TV, and it made headlines everywhere. Jeb spent days trying to clean it up, until he finally reversed himself on the answer. Many who had thought Jeb the odds-on favorite suddenly started to ask, what if he's not? Chris Christie was seen as a straight-talking tough guy and was always fun to interview, but he was dogged by an exchange he had had with President Obama prior to the last election, in which Christie appeared to fawn over the president, who had fast-tracked Hurricane Sandy relief funds to New Jersey. Republicans were having a hard time forgiving the governor for that display. Or maybe it was just that Christie had been out-Christied by Trump. Marco Rubio was also a contender at that early point. He was someone with a great personal story, conservative credentials, and Hispanic heritage, in a party looking to increase its performance with Hispanic voters. But he had co-sponsored the immigration reform bill a couple of years back, and in the 2016 Republican Party, that was anathema. Rubio has a good-looking, boyish face, but for some reason he struggled to connect the way an Obama or Clinton or George W. Bush had. His promising run never quite soared. As for who I suspected might take the nomination going into that first debate, I told Doug, watch Ted Cruz. Cruz, as I mentioned, was the first guest ever on the Kelly File. I liked having him on. He was interesting. He had come to my office a year before his presidential announcement with his press person. He spent an hour and a half with me just chatting. I knew he wasn't there because he loved my tiny office and assumed he was laying the foundation for a presidential run. He's not a particularly well-liked guy, as you may have heard, but I found him perfectly affable one-on-one. He is the smartest man in almost any room. That was borne out as we saw him navigate the primaries. During the run-up to the first debate, I noticed which of the candidates, like Cruz, Rubio, Huckabee, or Carson, could sit for a tough interview and roll with it, and which ones would throw a fit. They shall remain nameless here. Suffice it to say that many would call up my bookers after the segments and complain about what I'd asked them. They want George Washington's job, I'd marvel to my team, but they don't want to deal with tough questions to get there. Some interviews call for a punch between the eyes, especially if the candidate's been saying controversial things. Others allow, or even require, a softer touch. Over an election cycle, it all balances out. As for Trump, believe it or not, he and I were once mutual fans. The beginning of our relationship was perfectly friendly. I used to watch The Apprentice and thought he was entertaining. I never interviewed him much, but I saw him on Fox News a lot. And during the lead-up to the 2012 presidential election, I had him on America Live once. In December 2011, Trump wanted to moderate a Republican primary debate hosted by Newsmax in Iowa. Most of the candidates declined the invitation. Trump pulled out and the debate was canceled. I went over to Trump Tower and interviewed him about it. "I would be the best debate moderator ever," he said. I joked with him. "Do you really think you'd be better than me?" "Oh no," Trump said. "I could never be a better moderator than you, Megan." Someone cleverly dredged up that exchange once he started going after me for my moderating in the 2016 election. There was actually a funny moment in that interview where he let me run my fingers through his hair to prove that it was his own. Yes, I touched the famous hair. He had a sense of humor about it. He was not afraid to be playful. Following the launch of the Kelly File in October 2013, I had Trump on a total of twice in the next 21 months. I enjoyed interviewing him. He was fun to watch, irreverent, and you never knew what he was going to say. Apart from that, I had no contact with him. Then, in the winter of 2015, 6 months before he announced his candidacy for president, Trump began reaching out to me, often. At the time, I figured he liked my show. In retrospect, I see that he was attempting to charm me in advance of his presidential bid. Starting around February, he began calling me and sending me personal notes. When the New York Times Magazine ran a cover story about me by Jim Rutenberg called "The Megyn Kelly Moment," Trump mailed me a copy of the article, which he had personally signed. The accompanying note read, "Great article, especially from the source." Once he forwarded me a Christmas card he found amusing. Another time he sent me a note about his high speaking fees. I thought, why is he telling me this? "And to think," I wrote back, "we can get you for free." He would call me up to chat about a segment after it aired, to compliment how I had handled a guest. One time Trump invited me and Doug to Mar-a-Lago, the historic oceanfront mansion and club he owns in Palm Beach. He followed up by sending me pictures of the 17-acre property and estate. It was an invitation I would never accept, though plenty of others who hold themselves out as journalists have. "It's Mr. Trump again," Abby would say, pointing to the phone. "Why is he calling?" I would mouth to her. We would look at each other as if to say, "What's going on here?" In April 2015, Abby knew I was going to be at Trump Soho, Trump's downtown New York City hotel, for a weekend vacation with my Chicago friends, Andrea and Rebecca. Abby was friendly with Trump's assistant from all the calls he had placed to us, so Abby asked her for a restaurant recommendation near the hotel. Apparently, the assistant told Trump about it. She called Abby back and said, "Mr. Trump is going to take care of Megan's girls' weekend." "Oh no," I said, realizing that he may have thought I had been angling for that. Abby called right back and say, "Thank you so much, but I cannot accept that." She did, but the next time he came on my show, he told me directly, "I'm gonna take care of your girls' weekend." "Thank you," I said, "but you know I can't accept that." "I'm taking care of it," he replied. "No," I told him. "I've got it," he insisted. "Mr. Trump, not only am I not permitted to accept gifts like that, I certainly can't accept them from someone who might run for president." This was not long before he announced his bid. Trump started to sense that I wasn't going to play, and he seemed slightly irritated by my refusal. "Abby," I said when I got back to my office, "email them and put it in writing that I am paying for everything that weekend." And I did. I paid for every last cent. When I went on stage at that first presidential debate in August 2015, I had a printout of that email under my debate papers, just in case Trump tried to discredit me. By that point, I had seen him slam countless other people who had accepted his gifts and then fallen out of his favor. This is actually one of the untold stories of the 2016 campaign. I was not the only journalist to whom Trump offered gifts clearly meant to shape coverage. Many reporters have told me that Trump worked hard to offer them something fabulous, from hotel rooms to rides on his 757. the few reports that have been made public, veteran reporter Wayne Barrett says Trump offered him an apartment, writer Mark Bowden says Trump tried to win him over with a book deal, are from years ago, but make clear Trump's history of trying to buy positive media coverage. In addition to gifts, Trump used praise. This is smart, because the media is full of people whose egos need stroking. Trump would flatter certain people on Twitter, singling them out for their incredibly fair, smart coverage. One was even teased with a possible role on Celebrity Apprentice. Trump's Twitter followers would respond with accolades, and occasionally you would see the commentator respond with gratitude. Trump tried to work the refs, and some of the refs responded. One pro-Trump host called up a conservative writer who had been critical of Trump and told him, "You understand where this is going, right? He's going to be president. It's not too late for you to get on board. Get behind him." This host tries to pass himself off as unbiased, as objective, but his behavior raises the question, how many other phone calls like that took place? When it became too obvious that some media figures were in the tank, certain TV hosts actually took to gaming out with Trump, in advance, the hits they would have to do on him occasionally, to make themselves appear unbiased. I have been told this directly by more than one TV executive at more than one network. One news star would go over the subjects and even the questions with which he would be challenging Trump just before their interviews. "I have to give you a hard time on X," the host would explain, softening the on-air blow so the candidate would not get angry and cut off access. Another very well-known host would call up Trump before criticizing the candidate and warn him, "I have to hit you. I'm getting killed on credibility." And Trump, the famous counterpuncher, mysteriously didn't hit back after those pre-gamed attacks. Why do you think that was? This is an egregious breach of journalistic ethics. It is absolutely inappropriate whether they consider themselves journalists or not. You don't act the part of an independent, objective host and secretly rehearse your exchanges with a candidate. Ever. If neither gifts nor praise worked, Trump would use insults or threats. Commentators like Charles Krauthammer, Britt Hume, George Will, Jonah Goldberg, Dana Perino, Rich Lowry, Steve Hayes, Mark Thiessen, and Chris Dierwalt, to name a few, were derided as dummies or losers or lightweights or failures for offering their honest, albeit unflattering, analysis of Trump. Anyone who didn't fall under the Trump spell was fair game. Plenty of straight news reporters were hit too. The Des Moines Register's journalists were banned from Trump's campaign events because the paper's editorial board had harshly criticized him. The Washington Post was later banned for similar reasons. So were Univision, The Daily Beast, and others. The message was clear. Cover Trump nicely and good things happen. Hit him too hard and suffer the consequences. He had been laying the groundwork for that basic strategy for months before he launched his campaign. In June, Trump announced his candidacy. Weeks before that, he had appeared on my show. As we sat on the set getting ready for the segment, he could hear me discussing with my producers in the control room which polls I needed. Trump did not approve of my choices. "I really hope you won't discuss those polls," Trump said. "Oh, we have to," I told him. They were terrible for Trump back then. "Well, you should mention this other poll," he protested, naming a far less reputable poll in which he was doing a little bit better. He was trying to manipulate my coverage. "That's fine. People try to do that all the time." "Mention that if you want to. That's for you to do, not me," I told him. "I'm going to talk about the latest poll from Bloomberg." He was not happy with the segment. As I said, politicians are often unhappy with their appearances, or at least pretend to be so that you will feel you owe them one. It never bothers me. It's not my job to please them, only to be fair to them. A month or two later, in July, after Trump had formally declared, we had him on again. It was a rough time for Trump in some ways. Macy's and NBC were ripping him for comments he had made about Mexicans being rapists. "And some, I assume, are good people," he added in his campaign announcement. Macy's broke up with him. NBC ended his Miss Universe deal. It was a crazy story. Major companies publicly battling with a presidential candidate? When does that happen? Tom and I knew this was a big story. During the pre-taped interview, Trump kept going off topic to talk about China and trade, which he knew would play well with his base. As the world would later see, Trump would come to talk about China and trade every chance he got in the primaries. You could ask him, "How's the weather?" And he would respond, "We need to get tough with China." Months later, Brett and I were on set one primary election night. Trump had won and was giving a speech about his victory, saying, "We never win anymore. We're going to start winning again." A man in the audience yelled out, "China!" Brett and I marveled at Trump's messaging prowess. He had his supporters marching in lockstep with him. At the end of the lengthy pre-tape on Macy's and his NBC Univision dispute, I thanked Trump, and he said, "I hope you'll keep all of my remarks." "We won't be able to do that," I said. "It's way too much for one block." "I really hope you'll keep the whole thing." "We can't," I said. Again, he seemed annoyed. We did leave in some of what he said about China. Any candidate will get mad if you never let them highlight some of their own message. But he had mentioned it a dozen times, so most of it got cut. I heard later that, again, he was not happy. Two things stand out about that appearance in retrospect. One, he was already trying to control my coverage of him. And two, he was already remarkably adept at pushing a few core messages. And he had a read on the American electorate that few, if any, of the other candidates, not to mention party bosses or journalists, did. From the beginning, Trump knew what made good TV. I remember the first time the Kelly File took a Trump campaign event and put it on the air. It was July 2015. Trump went down to the Mexican border and held a presser, and we aired it. It was riveting. It was one of the most compelling political events we had seen in years, and no news came out of it. It was just Trump being Trump. Unscripted, unguarded, and fun to watch. We couldn't take our eyes off of it. The next day we saw the ratings, and there had been a huge pop. The viewers felt the way we did. This was great TV. Trump held another campaign event not long thereafter. We took that too. Same result with the ratings. It was then that Tom and I looked at each other and realized something was going on here. We knew we had made a questionable choice. This was television crack cocaine, and while it might feel good in the moment, we felt guilty afterward. Tom and I had a talk about the Trump coverage we were seeing in the cable news universe, and soon thereafter, broadcast news too. Trump was amazing TV, but what was the cost of giving him all that time when we knew damn well we weren't about to do the same for Jeb Bush or Scott Walker? Tom and I agreed, no more gratuitous Trump coverage. This was not a directive to cover Trump negatively or to ignore him. It was a call to remember our journalistic duty, to provide balance and be judicious in our coverage, not to sell our souls for ratings or for our own entertainment. "When the postmortem is done on the Trump campaign," I said, "let's make sure we're on the side of the angels." We would wind up rather lonely in that place. Some other television executives and anchors made different choices. The amount of free TV time Trump was given dwarfed all others. In the first few months of his campaign, he received close to $2 billion worth of media attention, roughly double the haul of the next best earner, Hillary Clinton. In 1 month, he earned in free media about what John McCain spent on his entire 2008 campaign. Of Trump's run, CBS chairman Les Moonves said, "It may not be good for America, but it's damn good for CBS. Man, who would have expected the ride we're all having right now? The money's rolling in, and this is fun." Like many things, Trump was fun, until suddenly he wasn't. In late July 2015, my relationship with him took a turn for the worse. The week before the first Republican primary debate, a report about Trump broke in the Daily Beast. A reporter named Tim Mack had dredged up the divorce proceedings between Donald and Ivana Trump, in which Ivana had testified that Trump raped her. According to her sworn deposition testimony, Ivana had encouraged Trump to have surgery to cover a bald spot. She claimed that he came home in great pain and was angry with her for encouraging him to do it. She described a violent assault in which he held back her arms and tore out pieces of her hair, then ripped off her clothes and raped her. On one hand, this was under oath testimony. On the other, it was a divorce proceeding, and it was from 30 years ago. I thought about ignoring it, but the story had gotten a ton of pickup, and so I decided to bring Tim Mack on the show to press him on his reporting. You are under fire for writing a piece about a man's divorce, allegations made in it, from 3 decades ago, I said to Mack by way of opening. Why did you think this was relevant? He said it was relevant because Trump had accused Mexican immigrants of being rapists. I suggested that was hardly a strong connection, and I continued on. Having practiced law for 10 years, I told Mack, divorce proceedings are notoriously ugly. Spouses often say things that aren't true and that they live to regret. How did you account for that reality in your reporting? I also pointed out that Ivana had later recanted her testimony. Mack struggled a bit, but handled himself all right. Unlike Trump's attorney, Michael Cohen, who responded to the Daily Beast article with threats and thug tactics. First, Cohen publicly defended Trump by saying, "You cannot rape your spouse. There's very clear case law." "This is untrue, as any lawyer from this century should know." He was later forced to walk this back. In between bouts of misstating the law, Cohen managed to find time to threaten Mack for reporting on the story at all. I quoted a bit of Cohen's strong-arm statement on the show, but this is the full text of what Cohen said. "I will make sure that you and I meet one day while we're in the courthouse, and I will take you for every penny you still don't have, and I will come after your Daily Beast and everybody else that you possibly know. So I'm warning you, tread very effing lightly, because what I'm going to do to you is going to be effing disgusting. You understand me? You write a story that has Mr. Trump's name in it, with the word rape, and I am going to mess your life up. For as long as you're on this frickin' planet, you're gonna have judgments against you. So much money, you'll never know how to get out from underneath it." This seemed significant enough to me to mention with Mack. I didn't dwell on it, but it was notable. So we noted it. The next day, I got a call from Roger Ailes. "What did you do to piss off Trump?" he said. I learned that Trump was, to say the least, not happy that I had given this story any oxygen and had called my boss. He had come to think of Fox as his friend. He is, in fact, friends with Roger and with many people at the network. He and I were friendly as well. And so when I did that segment, he felt like I had broken some kind of covenant. Trump was booked to come on my show soon after, Monday, August 2nd, which was the Monday before the first presidential debate. But that Monday morning, Trump refused to come on unless I called him personally. And so I called him up from the back of my car. That phone call was the beginning of the most bizarre year of my life, my year of Trump. "How could you?" he said instead of hello. "Mr. Trump," I said, "that story was everywhere. I did you a favor by having the reporter on and telling the other side." "Oh, no," he said. "That story never should have been on your show. O'Reilly didn't put it on his show." "Well," I said, "Bill is not my editorial gauge." He was especially enraged that I hadn't mentioned on the show that, in addition to recanting, Ivana had said she thought Trump would make an incredible president. That had not been relevant to the propriety of Mack's reporting, which was the topic at hand. "I read Ivana's statement rebutting the rape allegations, Mr. Trump. That's what was relevant to the story we were discussing." "You had no business putting it on your show," he said. Oh, I almost unleashed my beautiful Twitter account against you, and I still may. "You don't control the editorial content on the Kelly file, Mr. Trump," I said. And that was when he snapped. "That's it," he shouted. "You're a disgrace. You should be ashamed of yourself. You should be ashamed of yourself." He hung up on me. My driver looked at me. "That went well," I deadpanned. Needless to say, Trump canceled his appearance on the Kelly file for that night. I called Roger, as well as the head of the debate team, to alert them to what had just happened. The debate was in less than 4 days, and Trump was not happy. He hadn't pulled out of the debate, but it was conceivable that he might. So much of what he had done so far had surprised us. I considered that Trump just might be nervous about his first presidential debate, and I tried not to worry about it. But there had been something more in that phone call. I believe Trump had realized, once and for all, that he could not control me. He had failed to woo me with his offerings. He had failed to threaten me into submission. And I believe this made him anxious. When I said he couldn't control the editorial content of my show, it appeared to finally dawn on him that it might be true. So he launched a campaign to bring me in line before the coming debate. Chapter 20, The First Debate. The Fox News debate moderating team had been set for months. Brett, Chris Wallace, and me. At that point, the moderators were hoping the Fox News management would limit the debate to just the top six candidates, so there would be more time for give and take between them. But we were already under fire for cutting it down to 10, and 10 was about as small as the Fox News brass was willing to go. We knew that with 10 candidates, they would have very little time to engage with one another, so it would be on us, the moderators, to hit them with the toughest questions. Meanwhile, Trump, having realized in our phone call that he could not control me, tried to go over my head to get others to do it for him. In the days leading up to the debate, Trump called more than one executive at Fox in an attempt to rein me in. No one suggested to me that I should go easy on Trump at that debate, nor would that have worked, even if they had. Trump called our then executive vice president of news, Michael Clementi. He called Bill Salmon, the head of our debate team, and at this point our D.C. bureau chief. Kim Hume had retired years earlier. He called Roger. He wanted assurances about me, although no one ever told me exactly what they were. To my knowledge, Trump wasn't pushing to have me removed from the debate team, but he did want a message sent. I was starting to wonder where this was leading. I had pointed questions for Trump, but my questions for all of the candidates were tough, as were Brett's and Chris's. I wasn't about to dial back on one candidate just because he was complaining in advance. The day before the debate, Trump called Bill Salmon again, clearly anxious about the debate and about me in particular. He said he had heard that my first question was a very pointed question directed at him. How could he know that, I wondered. The debate prep is sacred to the five of us on the debate team, Salmon, Chris Steirwalt, part of our decision desk on election night, and our digital politics editor, Brett, Chris Wallace, and me. I knew no one on our team would ever have breathed a word about our questions to anyone, much less to one of the candidates. But Trump was extremely agitated, and Salmon tried to calm him down. Trump was not appeased. I spent a lot of time pacing the Fox News hallways on the phone. Folks were starting to worry about Trump. His level of agitation did not match the circumstances. Yes, it was his first debate, but this was bizarre behavior, especially for a man who wanted the nuclear codes. Though I usually tried to find humor in any situation, I didn't find much to laugh about here. He seemed very anxious about me. Given the number and nature of his calls, it seemed like I was his chief concern rather than the competitors heading for the stage. Meanwhile, the question that he hated so much in the debate had been written weeks earlier, before the Ivana story, before the beautiful Twitter account threat. We had been working for 2 months on debate prep. My research assistant, Emily Walker, had prepared a huge binder on every candidate for me, and having read Trump's cover to cover, it was clear that his Achilles heel was women. I went to the woman place with Trump because it was obvious this was an issue he would eventually have to face, especially if he were to run against Hillary Clinton. And so, under this cloud, we flew to Cleveland. I wasn't out to kill Trump, but he wasn't going to have an easy time either. Some would later claim the tough questions for Trump were pursuant to a Rupert Murdoch directive. Nonsense. There was zero interference in our debate questions by anyone in Fox management. I was a bit on edge about asking the question because I knew Trump was already focused on me. I also knew I had to ask it. These guys were running for president, for Pete's sake. I talked to Tom Lowell, who is not involved in my debate prep but is always a chief advisor to me, as well as the entire Fox News debate team. The five of us had gone over each of our questions dozens of times. We finessed and toughened them. We eliminated parts of them. We added to them, got rid of some, and in some cases wrote new and better ones up until the last minute. We did have a debate about the propriety of the line in my question, about Trump telling a contestant on Celebrity Apprentice that it must be a pretty picture to see her on her knees. We talked first about whether the line was taken out of context. It was not. There was video. Brandi Roderick, a contestant on Trump's show, was sitting across a table from Trump. Brett Michaels, sitting next to her, mentioned that Roderick had begged on her knees to be project manager. Trump smirked. "Excuse me, you dropped to your knees?" "Yes," she said. "That must be a pretty picture," Trump said, "you dropping to your knees." The camera cut to a laughing Piers Morgan. It was not out of context. The next issue was whether or not it was appropriate for a primetime debate audience. "Do you think it's appropriate for the decorum of a presidential debate to make a reference to oral sex?" asked Bill Salmon. "The very fact that you have to ask me that is the reason I have to ask it," I responded. "This guy is seeking the highest office in the land, and he said it on the air, on national television, to an aspiring female professional. It's fair game." After the debate, Roderick would come out and say she hadn't even remembered him saying it. "I don't condone men being derogatory," she said on MSNBC. "But he's on television. He's trying to be funny. I don't think he meant anything horrible by it." Fair enough. But the truth was, this wasn't about Brandy's feelings. It was about Trump's history with women and how it might affect his electability, running against a woman. One of the things we addressed in debate prep was what to do if Trump went after me, once I asked the question. I said to Brett and Chris, "If he does, don't try to help me." They both said variations of, "Oh, don't worry. We'll be behind you. Way behind you." They knew I could handle myself. And anyway, they had no particular desire to inject themselves into that back and forth. On the last day of debate prep, once the questions were set, Brett, Chris, and I looked at each other. I said, "This is it. If anyone has a problem, speak now or forever hold your peace." Mine were not the only tough questions, not by a long shot. Chris was going after Trump on his 4 bankruptcies. Brett was going to open the debate by asking the candidates if they promised to support whoever the Republican nominee was. It was a controversial, dramatic way to start. I was hitting Scott Walker on abortion and Ben Carson on foreign policy. The first round of questions in particular was the Olympics of questioning. No one has gone harder on the candidates than we did in that opening round. It was electric. It was journalism. And it was spectacular. We were all in. To figure out who would open the debate team huddled in the Cavaliers' locker room. Steyerwalt went to get a coin to flip and came back holding one with a queen on the front. They looked at me and said, "Call it." I said, "I gotta side with the queen." The queen won. I opened up the debate. Brett opened up the next one, and I did the third. The moment backstage before we went out in the arena, we were like a sports team putting all hands in. We walked out together. I knew I had the support of my co-moderators and the network. Even Britt had been in our debate prep the final day, for which I was thankful. I read him my opening question to Trump about the women. "It's a great question," he said. So I went out to the stage feeling fine about it. However, physically, of course, I was not feeling fine, since I had been violently ill for most of the day. Moments earlier, as I walked from my dressing room to the debate stage, surrounded by my team, my research assistant, Emily Walker, Abby, Chris, and Vincenza, I felt my mojo start to come back. I started to feel less shaky and ill, more geared up and focused. The endorphins began to flow. Bill Shine, our executive vice president of programming at the time, was in the hallway, just outside the debate stage entrance. He pulled out his camera and shot a picture of me. In it, I am walking toward Shine, pointing at the camera ninja-like. If I could caption that photo, I would call it triumphant. And I was off. The debate began, and it was raw, pure, all-encompassing excitement. I had a blanket on my lap and an empty trash can at my feet in case I threw up again, but I was confident I wouldn't. Now my adrenaline was pumping. The opening round boiled down to, "Are you electable? Republican voters may like you a lot, but if you're too extreme or uninformed or inconsistent, it could pose a problem for the party. We're here to find out, can you win?" This was a process of elimination. Each opening question was an A-plus level question. 3 Fox News anchors, no holds barred. The drama started immediately when Brett asked the candidates if anyone was not prepared to say they would support the eventual nominee of the party. We weren't sure how many hands we would get. We assumed Trump and Rand Paul might stand out. Only Trump raised his hand. In doing so, he sent a clear message to the millions watching at home that he was a different kind of candidate, one not concerned with pleasing the party elders. While Trump handled himself just fine in the moment, I now know he was very unhappy with the question. Moments later, I asked Trump the women question, and he became even more unhappy. "Mr. Trump," I said, "one of the things people love about you is you speak your mind, and you don't use a politician's filter. However, that is not without its downsides, in particular when it comes to women. You've called women you don't like fat pigs, dogs, slobs, and disgusting animals." He interrupted halfway through with a line, "Only Rosie O'Donnell." The audience erupted in laughter. There was no way I was going to laugh. It would have been inappropriate for one thing, and for another, what he said was not true. By that point, I was well aware of everything he had said about Rosie O'Donnell and what she had said about him. And in Trump's defense, Rosie gave as good as she got during her tiff with Trump. That's why I was determined in crafting the question to include more than just his references to Rosie. My question has been fact-checked many times since then, and every part of it has been verified by every publication to look into the matter. Trump had a long pattern of attacking women for not being, in his view, pretty or sexually appealing enough. In fact, there was so much material that I left most of it on the cutting room floor. He talked about wanting a young and beautiful piece of ass by his side, and said of his approach with the opposite sex, "You have to treat him like shit." He'd rated countless women's looks on a scale from 1 to 10. He had lamented how unattractive Bill Clinton's alleged lovers had been, just to name a few. So when he tried, somewhat predictably, to say it was only Rosie O'Donnell, I was prepared to fact-check him on the spot. "For the record," I said, "it was well beyond Rosie O'Donnell." Even Trump had to admit that was true in the moment. Then I continued. "Your Twitter account has several disparaging comments about women's looks. You once told a contestant on Celebrity Apprentice it would be a pretty picture to see her on her knees. Does that sound to you like the temperament of a man we should elect as president? And how will you answer the charge from Hillary Clinton, who is likely to be the Democratic nominee, that you are part of the war on women?" Trump responded that we've gotten too politically correct in this country. And on that, I agree with him, as do many voters. Whether that excuses his comments about women, well, that was the voters' job to decide. My job was simply to shine a light. "What I say is what I say," he continued. "And honestly, Megan, if you don't like it, I'm sorry. I've been very nice to you, although I could probably maybe not be, based on the way you have treated me, but I wouldn't do that." I noticed the shot, but moved on, glad the exchange had gone relatively well. After that, I was relieved. I knew the hardest part of the night was over, and the rest felt like downhill skiing. When the whole thing was over, I was elated. I believed the debate had gone very well. It was riveting. Everyone was on their game, and the ratings the next day would confirm it. Brett, Chris, and I exchanged congratulations, and I hightailed it off the stage. Immediately after we wrapped, I had to do my show live from what they call Spin Alley in the convention center. At 11 p.m. sharp, I rushed from the debate stage to my set, perched in the middle of a swarm of reporters. During that live broadcast, with reporters wall to wall around him, Trump walked by my set. He yelled out, "Megyn Kelly is not nice. She is no good." I chose not to acknowledge it. The media saw how angry he was, and he did not mince words in interviews that night, describing my woman question as nasty and unfair. I saw my fellow reporters eating it up, apparently reluctant to challenge his characterizations. Trump's annoyance built from there. He retweeted followers calling me overrated, angry, and a bimbo, and he directly called me not very good or professional. He said I really bombed tonight. People are going wild on Twitter. Funny to watch. Some reporters openly speculated about whether Trump himself could be sending these tweets. Being accustomed to politicians unhappy with their coverage, I wasn't particularly concerned with these criticisms. They usually got over it quickly. In fact, I understood Trump's anger. He was new to the political process, standing up there next to a bunch of political pros who had been through dozens of debates in their careers, and he didn't know what to expect. He said repeatedly that we were not nice to him. No one ever promised we would be nice. Debates aren't cocktail parties. However, all of this was new to Trump, who thought he had a good relationship with Fox News, which he does, with these moderators, which he did, and that his presence on that stage would help drive huge ratings, which it did. He felt betrayed. I get it. I don't agree with it, but I get it. By the end of the primary debate process, Trump would be far more savvy. He understood that these things could be very tough, and he was more up to the task. He learned to project, "I'm a winner," instead of, "I'm a whiner," after the debates were over. That shift did not, however, include moving on from what happened with me. The next morning at the airport in Cleveland, sitting with Abby at a cafe, I scrolled through my phone. Half of what I saw were great reviews and kudos. The other half were incredibly nasty messages from Trump and his supporters. He was repeatedly ripping on me in interviews and on Twitter. Beautiful Twitter account indeed. Holy shit, I thought, he's really going for it. At that point, I figured he'd wear himself out. I still believe it would not have been nearly as big a deal if Trump hadn't reacted the way he had. Every one of the candidates got extremely tough questions that night, but Trump was the only one to complain. Trump's extraordinary reaction was enough to draw millions of eyeballs to the woman question over and over and over again. I wondered whether that was a smart tactical move on his part. Having been on TV for over a decade, I had seen plenty of on-air exchanges go viral on the internet. But this was in a league of its own. It was everywhere. Everywhere. Broadcast, cable, talk radio, print, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, every online site known to man, domestically and internationally. Peru, Brazil, Italy, and beyond. My brother Pete texted to see how I was holding up. My sister wrote me, "Put on some Willy Wonka, and remember, you can run circles around any of these people." "I have every confidence in you, honey," my mom said. "You never met a man you couldn't handle." As soon as we arrived in New York, I headed into Fox News. I had agreed to do a pre-taped interview that day with Howie Kurtz, Fox's media watchdog, for his Sunday show. In the on-camera exchange, I told him, "I'm sure nerves were high, as they were for all of the candidates. Trump felt attacked. It wasn't an attack. It's okay with me that there's some consternation."